It's crunch time at the state capitol. California's budget has to be finalized in the next couple of days for it to pass the legislature by the June 15th constitutional deadline. Capitol Bureau Chief Ben Adler will explain the issues that may be holding up the process. Also, Sacramento celebrates Pride and the legacy of Stonewall this weekend, and the LGBTQ community is debating whether gay police officers should march in uniform. We'll talk about the intersection of orientation, identity, race, and law enforcement with trans activist Ebony Harper. And we'll be talking about mental health and restaurant work. I'm Randall White, in for Beth Ruyak. That's all today on Insight. First, here's the news. We're live from Capitol Public Radio in Sacramento. This is Insight. I'm Randall White, in for Beth Ruyak today. It's crunch time at the state capitol. That's because California's budget has to be finalized no later than midnight on June 15th. And there are many special interests and major projects that need to get their funding between now and then. And of course, this is politics, so not everyone is in agreement of what gets money and how much. Capitol Bureau Chief Ben Adler is at the Capitol to educate us on those issues that might be getting the most attention. Ben, let's start with the fact that this time around we have a different governor, but the same legislative leaders. What, if anything, is likely to be different?
Well, good morning, Randall, from the Assembly Press Bay, where we're expecting a little bit of a short session because there's a long day's worth of budget work and negotiations that will be getting underway. So, yes, what is different? Well, here's the thing about budget negotiations, at least that I've observed, and there is a rhythm to them year after year. And when there's a new player at the table, that rhythm gets adjusted for that new player. And that happens even more so when that new player is the governor, because the governor's January budget and then the updated budget known as the May revise that comes out mid-May. I mean, those form really the building blocks, the basis of the core of a state budget deal. And then lawmakers will do their things around the edges. They will add more things. They will bring more perspectives into the conversation, if you will. But what ends up happening is you generally have the governor's budget, and then there are extra things that lawmakers can add. Usually Dem leaders and others will set priorities. And so we're trying to figure out how that's all going to work out this year. And I think to some extent the legislature and governor, or new governor, are feeling each other out.
And because of the makeup of the legislature, Democrats have the lion's share of the say of what happens, but Republicans have a say as well. And as I understand it, you have the top Republican on the Assembly Budget Committee there with you to give us that perspective.
Oh, I wish lawmakers came exactly when their staff said they would. We are very much expecting to have Republican Jay Obernolte of Southern California with us momentarily. I can see his staff outside haranguing to get him over here. But we don't have him quite yet. The way budget negotiations work, once upon a time, you had what's called the Big Five. Legislative leaders from both parties, Democrats and Republicans, negotiating with the governor. Then, just as Arnold Schwarzenegger was leaving office, California voters passed a ballot measure, Proposition 25, that made budget bills majority vote. And with that, and the election of a Democratic governor, the Big Five immediately became the Big Three. Republicans are no longer at the bargaining table for the state budget. It's not to say that lawmakers who work collegially through the budget process can't have some say, but it does mean that they're not making the final decisions at that table. And so these are the days right now. We expect the outlook of a deal, the outlines of a deal, to emerge tomorrow evening. Yes, late Friday night, believe it or not. And I can explain why as we keep going in this segment, but what that means is it's a pretty precarious time for negotiations. The Democrats aren't willing to speak on the radio about it right now, but Republicans do have some idea of what's going to be in the budget, and that's why we're hoping to talk with Assemblyman Obernolte when he stops by. But in the meantime, we can talk about what we expect will be in the budget.
Yeah, and Cap Radio's healthcare reporter Sammy Kaola joined us in studio yesterday to talk about healthcare, and that a plan there might be one of the sticking points, right? There are various pieces of the budget related to healthcare.
So the governor proposed health care, expanding California's health care for low-income people, so Medi-Cal, to undocumented immigrants who are young adults living in California illegally. So right now, California, and for a few years now, California has offered Medi-Cal to undocumented children. And ever since then, Democrats have been trying to expand it to young adults, to seniors, to all adults. There's been various proposals. And both the governor and the legislative leadership on both houses have proposals in there for expanding Medi-Cal to serve undocumented young adults ages 18 through 25 or 26. The Senate also wants to expand to seniors, and so there is one area of contention. And the contention isn't about whether it should happen, because I think everyone on the Democratic side of the aisle here, or most everyone, I don't want to overgeneralize, most everyone would say that should be the case. But the question is whether the money is there to pay for it. And so that's one of the issues that's under discussion.
Ben, we just clearly heard a gavel. What was that for?
We are beginning session, and so the prayer and the Pledge of Allegiance are going to be coming up. And here it comes. Assemblyman Jay Obernolte will speak a little bit quietly during the prayer, but thank you for joining us on Capitol Public Radio.
Of course, it's an honor to be here.
So the Democrats aren't willing to talk about budget negotiations right now, but I would imagine that you have plenty to say. What's your view of the spending package that is coming together?
Well, I think it's easy to expand social programs in a year when we have a $21.5 billion budget surplus, but I think we always need to keep our eye on the fact that the surplus that we have is a temporary one, and structurally we need to make sure that the state's finances are sound in the event of a future downturn in state revenue.
Before you joined us, we were talking about various health care proposals. There's, you know, expanding Medi-Cal for undocumented young adults or perhaps seniors. There's the individual mandate at the state level replacing the canceled one at the federal level that would help fund subsidies for covered California for lower and middle class Californians. Among those proposals, is there anything that Republicans can get behind?
Well, I think that Republicans favor fixing Medi-Cal so it fulfills the promise that we're already making to the Californians that depend on it. Many of my constituents that I represent are technically covered by Medi-Cal, but in reality, they're unable to see a provider when they get ill because there are so few doctors who can afford to take the low reimbursement rates that Medi-Cal offers. So before we talk about expanding a failed program, I think we need to make sure we fix it and shore it up to make sure we're committing, meeting the commitments we've already made.
And I think one of the parties in the negotiations, and I'm blanking on which, whether it's the Assembly or Senate, one of the parties is trying, or maybe it's the governor actually, is trying to raise the reimbursement rates.
Yes, and that's something that I'm very much in favor of.
What about expanding subsidies on covered California to middle-class Californians? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think we need to be very cautious. I understand and agree with the premise, which is to make sure that more Californians are covered by health insurance. That fixes the system and makes it better for everyone. Unfortunately, it's not clear to me that there's any statistical evidence that extending these subsidies to the income ranges the governor is proposing would have that effect.
So there's also the proposal from the governor to begin moving toward universal preschool for four-year-olds. What are your thoughts on whether that is a good direction or too costly a direction for the state to move in?
Well, I'm a big fan of early childhood education. Statistically, the evidence is very clear that that's beneficial to children. Unfortunately, if you look at where we are at in terms of K-12 education, it's very clear that we're failing Californians. We are 46th in reading scores, 47th in math test scores. We are dead last in terms of student to teacher ratio of all 50 states. We've, in this budget, depending on where the Prop 98 guarantees, which ones we get adopted, we'll have raised the per student spending to a little over $12,000 per student. That still pits us, adjusted for costs, 41st among the 50 states. So I would really prefer us to shore up our K-12 system and fix some of the systemic structural problems that exist there before we talk about expanding and creating new other educational programs.
Now, Proposition 98 being that Byzantine state constitutional funding formula for schools and community colleges. We just saw Los Angeles voters reject a tax measure that would have sought to help fund LA schools after the strike and the deal that basically everyone agreed, look, we know there's not enough money there, we'll try to get more money. Sacramento's going through a similar situation, other school districts perhaps too. Is Proposition 98, even though it brings in roughly 40% of every penny that comes into state coffers for schools, is it not sufficient for California education? Should there be additional money for schools on top of that?
Well, I think we all need to keep in mind that Prop 98 was intended to be a floor for educational spending in California, and the legislature, unfortunately, treats it as a ceiling. Usually the legislature takes whatever the Prop 98 guarantee is deemed to be and adopts that as the state's spending plan, and that was never the intention.
Anything you'd like about what's in the budget? We don't know exactly what's in the final deal, but what you've been around enough to know how this final deal is going to shape up. What do you like that's going to be in there?
Well, certainly we're going to be putting a lot more money into reserves, regardless of whose figures we go with, the governors, the senates, or the assemblies. I'm very much in favor of the $3 billion that we're putting towards pre-funding PERS and STIRS, long-term liabilities. That's going to yield $2 or $3 in the future for every dollar we invest now. That's very prudent. We should end the fiscal year, with over $20 billion in reserves, which is great, but we need to be mindful of the fact that the LAO estimates that in even a moderate recession...
The Legislative Analyst Office, the nonpartisan budget watchdog.
Yes, they estimate that in even a moderate recession, we're going to have revenue loss of about $40 billion. So to put it another way, $20 billion is a great start. We're about halfway there.
One of the bones of contention between the governor and the Democrats in the legislature appears to be this issue that I almost don't want to get into, called tax conformity, but it's dealing with well over $1 billion in potential net revenue to California. It's basically conforming state tax law to the new federal tax overhaul that passed in Congress a couple of years ago, that Democrats, by the way, have criticized for how it treats upper-income earners in California. But California now considering conforming the law, and that would bring in, you know, some areas it would bring in less money, others bring in more money, but overall about $1.5 billion more money to California. There were some business groups down in the governor's office the other day saying, yeah, we're good with this. What do Republicans feel about it?
I think as conservatives, we're always wary of tax increases, but I think that tax conformity is in general a good thing. It makes the tax situation less complex for both businesses and for residents of California. We're talking about a lot of money here. It's almost $2 billion, about $1.7 billion, according to the latest figures that I've seen. And a lot of these provisions in the conformity would be fairly non-controversial. For example, for businesses, the federal tax law changed last year to make it so that net operating losses could not be carried backwards. And carrying an NOL backwards is something I've never really understood. Carrying it forward makes sense. Backwards, you know, I don't know what the justification for that would be. So a lot of these things are fairly non-controversial. I'll tell you what I'm absolutely not in favor of is to adopt tax conformity and take that $1.7 billion and use that extra revenue as an excuse to spend more somewhere else. That's something that's been attempted in the Budget Conference Committee that I'm very much not in support of.
What about using some of that money, as the governor proposes, toward expanding the state's earned income tax credit for low-income working Californians?
Right. I think we need to be very careful about the way that we expand EITC. I mean, it's in general, there's a lot of evidence that EITC encourages people to work and acts as a ladder out of poverty. These are good things, but we need to make sure that we're using things that are evidence-based, and there are some of some versions of that proposal that we're debating in the Budget Conference Committee that it's not clear to me that statistical evidence is there for.
I'd like to wrap up with a question that our host Randall asked me before you joined us, and that is, with a new governor but the same legislative leaders, what's different this year? There's a rhythm to these budget negotiations. What do you believe is different this year under this new governor?
Well, the Governor Newsom has made some changes to the Department of Finance. I really like the changes that he's made. The DOF has been very easy to work with this year. People that he has involved in the process are incredibly engaged. They're very intelligent. They know their stuff, as does he. You know, our governor is clearly a very intelligent guy, and he knows his budget statistics. The fact that he can stand up and present on his budget without his notes and without relying on staff is very impressive, and I value the fact that he reads and that he makes his own decisions.
All right. Republican Assemblyman Jay Obernolte, thank you for joining us. You're the vice chair of the Assembly Budget Committee. Thank you.
It's always an honor.
All right, Randall, so there we have it, and I think we are going to see some sort of budget deal begin to emerge Friday evening, and the reason for that is that next Saturday, June 15th, is the Constitutional budget deadline for the legislature to pass a spending plan. And in order for all of the whatever budget deal is agreed to get into print and be in print for 3 days as required by the state constitution before getting a final vote, and because lawmakers really don't want to be in town next Friday or Saturday voting on this budget, they want to vote it next Thursday, a week from today. That's why everyone is trying to close out the spending plan negotiations, these spending plan negotiations, tomorrow. And it's probably going to be, if it happens tomorrow night.
Capitol Bureau Chief Ben Adler live at the California Capitol. Hey, Ben, let's switch gears just a bit. There's a brand new poll out from the Public Policy Institute of California that suggests only Democrats in the state support impeachment. Can you tell us a bit more about what that poll found?
Yeah, it meshes not only with what national polls are saying, but also what we found in talking to Democratic Party delegates at the state convention over the weekend. Essentially that, well, you know, just because the Democrats might think that impeachment is really the way to go, that they haven't made the sale. And that's maybe, I don't know if it's surprising that it's the same in deep blue California as it is elsewhere, but independents in California, too, even in this state that voted for a Democratic governor, 60 to 40 or so last year, that voted for Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump by essentially a 2-to-1 margin in 2016, that these independents in California are not sold that impeaching the president is the right way to go.
In this same poll, there appears to be a generational split among California Democrats as to what matters more in picking a presidential nominee, electability or policy views.
Yes, and the younger you get, according to this poll, 18 to 44-year-olds more likely to support picking a presidential nominee, at least so they asked Democrats and Democratic-leaning independents, and more likely to go with someone whose policy views matches the voter. If you're 45 and older, you're more likely to go with electability. And earlier this week, we had our undecided voter roundtable on Insight, and there were three folks in their mid-50s and one in his 20s. The voter in his 20s was very much not about electability. And the three in their 50s, two of the three said electability clearly their top priority. Now, all four of them said they would vote for whichever Democrat is the nominee, but you do see the split that's going to play out in the primary campaign over the next several months.
So the poll also asked about some important issues to Californians. It found broad support for sweeping measures designed to build more housing by a 2-to-1 margin.
Yeah, so there are a couple of issues that kind of stalled or whose futures are uncertain right now. And starting with a proposal from Governor Gavin Newsom to tie transportation funding from SB1, that was the gas tax and vehicle fee increase that survived a ballot measure attempt last year that would have reversed it, to use that money and say, look, local governments, if you don't meet your housing goals, you're not going to get this money. Now, a lot of folks in the legislature pushed back. The governor was forced to delay the implementation date in his proposal. And right now, that issue is part of budget negotiations. There was also, as you know quite well, Randall, from your coverage of this issue, a bill called SB 50 in the Senate that would have forced cities to approve multifamily housing near transit hubs. And that was unilaterally sidelined by the chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee, Anthony Portantino, of the Los Angeles area a couple weeks ago. So both of those measures, when you ask about them, or both of those proposals, when you ask about them in this poll, they've got support by a 2-to-1 margin. And so it suggests that voters might see what legislators are doing, which is slow walking some of these proposals, as a mistake.
And SB 50, while sidelined, can come back next year.
Yes, sidelined for the end of this year, unless there is some sort of legislative procedure or shenanigan that resurrects it. Never discount that possibility in this building.
All right. We should know most of what's in the budget deal by the time we return next week. So, Ben, you're joining us on Monday's Insight to bring us the latest.
Assuming there is anything to talk about, and we do think there will be, yes, I will be around.
Excellent. Capitol Bureau Chief Ben Adler live at the California Capitol. Thank you, sir.
Head
to capradio.org to keep up to date with all of Ben's latest reporting on what's happening in the world of politics. You're listening to Insight. This is your NPR station, Capitol Public Radio. You're listening to Insight here on Capital Public Radio. I'm Randall White. This Sunday is the annual LGBTQ Pride March through downtown Sacramento, and this year it's commemorating the 50th anniversary of the uprising by New York's gay community at the Stonewall Inn. Organizers of the march are asking members of the Sacramento Police Department to not participate in the event in uniform, in an effort to honor the pain and marginalization of community members who have been harmed by police violence over the years. This move has stirred tremendous debate among everyone, but also within the gay community and beyond. Ebony Harper is a trans activist based in Sacramento, and she's one of three grand marshals for Sacramento Pride, and joins us now to help us understand the issue a little better. Welcome to Insight, Ebony.
Thank you, Randall.
Yeah, nice to have you here. So before we go anywhere, help us understand, how does one get selected to be a grand marshal?
Well, this year, for the first time ever, they had a voting structure, and so communities were allowed to vote for the grand marshal. So it was three of us that was selected out of the voting structure, and it's probably 5,000 votes that they gave, and so.
Well, congratulations!
Here I am.
Yeah.
Yes.
Tell us a bit about your work as being a trans activist.
Yeah.
How did you get started?
I got started in Oakland, and there was
Brandy. Is that where you're from originally?
No, I'm from Los Angeles.
Los Angeles. Uh-huh.
Yeah. I got started in Oakland. Brandy Martell, a black trans woman, was murdered in Oakland, and I actually just started on Facebook, and I was living in despair myself, and so I was advocating for myself and advocating for other trans women, and I moved here to Sacramento, started working at the Gender Health Center, got really entrenched in trans activism and local issues. And and organizing China Gibson's memorial and China Gibson's mural. We have a fabulous mural in downtown Sacramento.
Can you help us understand who China Gibson was?
China Gibson was a local performer. She was displaced by Hurricane Katrina, and there was housing opportunity out here, and so she came out here from New Orleans, and she was beloved by our community. So she went back to New Orleans and visited her family and friends, and she was murdered when she went to visit for Mardi Gras. And so it got national attention, and she was coming to Gender Health Center for services, and actually she was just about to get her confirmation surgeries, the 3 days before the murder, 3 days after the murder. And so it was a community outcry. I helped facilitate her memorial. And I was so struck by her death. I took that with me after I left to the Gender Health Center, to the California Endowment. And I spearheaded a mural in her honor. And so now in downtown Sacramento, Midtown, right behind the Lavender Library, we have a beautiful mural of China Gibson and her mother. And it says, "Protect our trans daughters." And it's changing the narrative of trans people being something other than human, something other than people's daughters, people's families, people's sons, and humanizing those, our experience.
And it's those earlier views that led to and leads to violence against the trans community.
Yes. Religion has a lot to do with it. You know, religion, cultural differences, and sometimes we're even discriminated against by our own LGB communities. And so my personal mission is to educate people and to change the narrative of us being other than other people. And we're people. We live, we breathe, we laugh, we want the same protections. We want to have the same rights, you know, as everyone else. We want to serve in the military if we want to, you know. There's a ban on trans folks serving in the military right now, which is crazy.
And recently enacted.
Yeah. And this administration is trying to remove health care protections for trans folks, too. So there's really an attack on our community. And, you know, Black trans people are on the bottom of the totem pole. And so Black community and the brown community, trans community, are really suffering. That's why this year, it's not just with Sacramento Pride, but prides throughout the nation are taking a stance for the marginalized trans community, which is predominantly Black and brown. And they get violence not only from their communities, urban communities, but from police. And so not just Sacramento Pride is taking a stance and saying that police aren't welcome in uniform because the uniform represents trauma in our community. It's Pride's all over. Indianapolis. And some of the police chiefs are saying, you know what? Yes, we do have work to do with the LGBT queer trans community. We do understand that there needs to be some type of relationship building in that community. And some have issued statements of apology, you know? And
well, the Sacramento Police Department updated the profile of its Facebook page on Monday to include a logo showing the word police displayed in rainbow colors. Mm-hmm. And then one of the comments from that update is from somebody named Richard, who says, we see you, we love you, we want you at Pride. Sacramento is our community and everyone is welcome. Thank you for all you do. Please do not give up on this fight. It's far from over. I look forward to seeing you proudly wearing uniforms this weekend. For police who do choose to show up in their uniform, how will they be treated? I'm not talking about the police working the event. I'm talking about police that are participating in the Pride events.
You know, I honestly can't speak to how they are going to be treated. I'm not facilitating Pride, so I can't speak to that.
And we did reach out to Sac Pride to ask them to have a representative here, but we did not hear back.
Yeah, I'm not here as a representative. I'm a grand marshal. I can't speak to how they're going to be treated. But I could say that it's not a time for ego. It's a time for community healing. And actually, this is an opportunity for the police department to show up in a way of reconciling some pain. And that uniform represents pain to our community. Some people have a tremendous amount of privilege where they don't understand and they don't see the pain firsthand. And so you really have to get educated on the issues, and you really have to get educated on the people that are on the bottom, that are constantly met with interactions that aren't good, aren't healthy. I am a very well-known activist here locally and nationally. If I'm walking by my house, I could get stopped and seen as a sex worker because I'm visibly trans. People sometimes think, you know, most trans people are sex workers. So that happens to a lot of trans folks. I just so happened to
have. Has it happened to you? Have you been stopped?
Yes. Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. Yeah. A couple of weeks ago. And so I was stopped and asked for my ID. And I said, no, I'm not giving you my ID. And he pushed on and was like, well, I need to see your ID. And I said, I have a job. You know, I'm well known in this community. But, you know, he still didn't believe me. And so we went on for a good 10, 15 minutes back and forth. I was just going to get laundry detergent. And then he finally said, you know, this is a high sex work area. And I don't know if you're out here sex working. And I was like, no, I'm not a sex worker. I have a job. I have a good job.
And this is where I live.
Yeah, this is where I live. And so anyway, I end up giving in and just showing him my ID so I can go. But that was a traumatic experience.
Right.
Yeah.
In addition to Sac Pride, we also reached out to the Sacramento Police Department. They did not have somebody available to be on the show today. But we do have a clip from Sacramento Police Officer Jeff Kuhlman, who represents those officers who would like to march in uniform this Sunday. And here's what he had to say this week on KCRA.
People say that they're not comfortable with officers in uniform, and that's one of the things that we want to try and fix. We want to make sure that people are comfortable walking up to a police officer when they see them in the police uniform. I've been to too many Pride events in the past where I've been in the uniform and been able to be part of those events and to express who I am as a police officer for my city, and I would like to be able to continue that.
How would you, Ebony, respond to Officer Kuhlman's his opinion there?
I would say that police officers are taking it as an identity. Like, I'm a black person. I can't take off my skin color. That's a uniform, and that uniform has a history of violence towards people of color, violence towards its community, and police are sworn to oath for the law. So it doesn't matter if you're a gay cop, if the law says to arrest another gay person, then that's your duty. So sometimes, or if you're a black cop and you have to arrest another black person, what if they're resisting arrest? Sometimes you have to use some hardcore techniques, you know, to subdue the person. And so that is violence towards that person. And so sometimes people who possess the same identity, maybe even a transgender cop, is used as a tool of violence towards another transgender person. Mm-hmm. So this debate shouldn't even be a debate. It should be a moment of healing and saying, you know what? There is a history. You know what? Ebony, trans community, you know, we're sorry about that history, and we're going to try to work to be better allies as police officers. If you want to use the police officer thing as an argument, as police officers, we're going to be better allies. We're going to, talk about the history of abuse. You can't just take on an identity like it's a race identity. Police can take off their uniform. And also, you could wear a shirt that says all the LGBT officers that's died in the line of duty instead of wearing a uniform. There's all kind of ways of navigating this rule.
We're speaking with Ebony Harper. She's a trans activist based in Sacramento and one of three grand marshals for Sacramento Pride. You mentioned history. The theme of the march this year is to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the police raid and subsequent uprising at New York's Stonewall Inn, a place where the gay community gathered. It was illegal in 1969 for gay people to have relations in New York and also in California. In fact, California didn't decriminalize being gay until 1975. Not entirely. It took the U.S. Supreme Court more recently to do that. During the time that it was illegal to be gay, police raids were common and often resulted in the beatings of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered people. It's partially, right, for this reason that Sacramento Pride does not want the presence of uniformed officers in the march. But some in the gay community are saying the act of officers in uniform marching side by side in solidarity with the gay community and many of those officers who are gay themselves is a great way to celebrate the changes that have transpired since Stonewall 50 years ago. Do you see that?
Just because a officer is LGBT and they get to serve as officers, like I said, there's still an oath sworn to the law, which sometimes the law doesn't work for certain people and it oppresses certain communities. So in theory, yes, that would be great to walk side by side with law enforcement in their uniform. But There's still a lot of people being oppressed, particularly Black and brown trans women that die at the hands of law enforcement. We don't have the privilege of calling the police. Sometimes when we call the police, it's turned on us when we have been the victim. And so there, I would still say, Randall, that there's some reconciliation that needs to happen. Yes, this is the 50th anniversary of Stonewall. Yes, we've come tremendously far, but we've left some people behind. We've left Black trans women behind. We've left brown trans women behind. And we've left API trans people behind. There's a lot more work to be done in the LGBT community. And now that we know that we left all these trans folks behind, they should be pushed to the forefront of the movement. They should be heard. Their issues should be heard. And right now we're explaining that we don't feel comfortable around those uniforms because those uniforms is a symbol of hurt, pain, and trauma in our community.
Ebony, you're very familiar with being discriminated for who you are. A couple of days ago, we did a story on this and then posted it, a link to it on our Facebook page. And that post has received many, many comments. I'm sure over the last few days you've seen social media explode because of this issue. Many of the people were posting a common theme. They want to know why an organization that promotes and preaches inclusivity is choosing now to discriminate based on a person's profession. How do you respond to those commenters?
Okay. Well, first of all, it's not discrimination on the profession. If you want to...
But you can see why people would see it that way. They cannot wear their uniform, and their uniform is their profession.
I can see how people misunderstand things. I can see how ignorance can even exist in the LGBT community. That they're not educated on issues. I know this is kind of a controversial topic, and this is going to be controversial what I'm saying, but if people came in swastikas, that would be an issue. If their profession was something that was abusive to people, that would be an issue. And policing is abusive to Black, brown, API trans.
But you're not
folks.
Comparing police to Nazis.
No, I'm just saying that particular profession represents abuse.
Ebony, what do you hope to see on Sunday?
I hope to see communities come together, and regardless if your profession is policing, and you're not able to wear your uniform, I still want you to come. I'll even hold your hand, and I want us to come together and change this narrative of we're all fighting and make it a moment of healing for all of us. I want to see law enforcement issue a public statement of apology instead of taking the stance of we're victims. I want them to acknowledge the victimizations of the people that have been victimized and say, we have to work from there. And then we can really talk.
You can meet Ebony on Sunday at Pride. Also, in Oakland at an event at the Oakland Museum of California on June 15th, In Conversation, Black Trans Women on Resilience and Strength. It is from 2 to 3:30 in the afternoon at the James Moore Theater. Ebony, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Randall. I really appreciate that.
That was Ebony Harper, a trans activist based in Sacramento. She's one of three grand marshals for Sacramento Pride. And you can find more on our website at capradio.org/insight. You are listening to Insight on your NPR station. This is Capital Public Radio. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Randall White, in for Beth Ruyak today. For many of us, coming together to break bread is a chance to nourish our bodies and our souls. Gathering around meals gives people time to connect, time to slow down. But for the chefs, servers, bartenders, and others who work in the hospitality industry, those moments of peace and respite can be rare at work. Now, Sacramento restaurateur Patrick Mulvaney is spearheading a growing effort to tackle the mental health challenges these professionals face in their fast-paced industry. And a string of sudden deaths last year in Sacramento's restaurant scene, including deaths by drug overdose and suicide, drove Mulvaney to act in an effort to reduce stigma and directly address the mental health challenges of hospitality professionals. He launched I Got Your Back. It's a peer support program launched at his Midtown restaurant, Mulvaney's B&L. It includes daily employee mood checks and training for staff to recognize the signs of distress. This month, it's expanding to other Sacramento restaurants as a six-week pilot program. This comes around the one-year mark of celebrity chef and television host Anthony Bourdain's suicide, which is marked on Friday. We're joined in studio by Patrick Mulvaney. Welcome to Insight. Nice to have you here.
Thank you for having us.
Set the stage for us, or I guess as the table, as the case may be. How is restaurant culture shifting to recognize and maybe even prioritize employees' mental health?
So it's a challenge, right? Because as you point out, we are focused on you. We are focused on, you know, it's your husband's 40th birthday, and is everything good for you? And we're looking out at that, and it's high-paced, and there's a lot of things coming at you. And sometimes we don't think about ourselves. And so the idea of I Got Your Back is taking hospitality, which is what we do. Are you welcome? Are you comfortable? Are you happy here? And turning it on ourselves. And so what's really happened in the last 6 months that we've been using this program is it's changed the culture of the restaurant. So instead of me saying, you cut yourself, get back on the line, hurry up, I don't care about how you're feeling, I want that steak to come out now and I want it right. Now we're saying, hey, how are you? Let's talk about it. And what happens is if you take that extra time, the people feel better, your work staff is better, they're happier, they stay longer, and you end up with a better product going to your table.
And because of this high-pressure situation that these workers find themselves in constantly, some can tend to self-medicate using alcohol and drugs. I'm sure you've seen this happen.
Sure. Alcohol, drugs, and some medicate by running, some medicate by avoiding people, all sorts of coping mechanisms, right? And it's because you're not communicating, right? Which is, it seems odd, right? In a world where we are storytellers and what we are doing is talking to people all day, that we're not talking about what really matters to us.
How did realizing that this is a problem in your industry change your approach with your own restaurant's culture and interaction with your employees?
And so when the Innovation Learning Network came together and created I Got Your Back for us, and we started using that idea, my wife was brilliant in saying, we do cool stuff, but we don't share it with everybody. And so we made a conscious effort to make it part of the daily discussion in the restaurant. And so over the course of a couple of months, we were talking about mental health every day. We were using the check-in box to see what people's moods were like, to say lots of happy people, some people are mean, three people are angry. We know who those people are. But hey, there's two blues in here. And we know the two of us don't feel good today. So would you give them a break and would you talk about it? So that after Christmas, when we lost someone on Christmas to suicide, and I brought the team together, our whole group, I saw that our 40 staff members were using all the tools that we had been discussing over the previous couple of months. And it's really changed, like I said, it's changed the culture in the restaurant for the better.
Sometimes a waiter or waitress can have 99 great customers and then one customer who says one thing that can flip the whole page, right?
Right, and take you off your beam. And so now, so now we have this space where we know it's okay to go out and back and calm down, or as Bobbin says, girlfriend, you need to cry, go in the walk-in, and I'm just going to stand in front of it. Nope, don't need anything in the walk-in. Someone's crying in there. We'll be back out in a second.
And the weather we've had the last couple of days, the walk-in's a great place to be. Also joining us is Nikki Thomas, whose experience with depression informed her participation in the project. Thank you for being here.
I'm honored to be here. Thank you.
Can you talk a little bit about your involvement in the earlier stages of all this?
Absolutely. I'm a senior researcher for an innovation lab, and we are a member of the ILN network. And I was assigned to this to help coordinate to get this activity going. And with my own mental health challenges, I found it to be extremely trying at times doing the research and putting this together. And I happened to have a moment where some of his, Patrick Mulvaney's sharing with the attendees, you know, the words really impacted me. And that personal connection I felt to his work and being inspired by him and his wife, Bobbin, and what they're trying to do for our community, it's already changed my life. And I feel that being able to have that conversation about being depressed and about being suicidal is life-changing. Wow. And very important.
It's very important for you also to reduce the stigma of mental illness, because there is a stigma.
Absolutely. There is a stigma. 2 years ago, I wouldn't have gone on air and said that I have mental health challenges and that I suffer with depression. And today I'm doing that because something needs to change.
Mm-hmm. And how do you go about that? How do you change what people have in their head when they hear somebody say, I have depression?
The more I speak about it, the more others open up. And I feel that when I was really struggling with depression at its, you know, heightened state, I felt alone. And that's really what drove me to the suicidal feelings, is feeling alone and like no one knows what to say to you. If someone could have just given me a hug and said the right words to me, I wouldn't have suffered for over 2 years with depression as intensely as I did. So I think that the more you hear it from other people, the more you're open about it, and the more we could maybe intervene and stop some of the depression and hopefully suicide.
Do you think people prone to depression might also be more attracted to working in the hospitality industry, to be around people, to have that those conversations with you never know who you're going to meet kind of thing?
I couldn't speak to that. I think that it does exist everywhere, though. So I know in my experience, I've seen it, and I've been in many industries, and I've seen it everywhere.
Patrick?
So we say, you know, Bourdain, when he wrote his book, he said that we were on a pirate ship and the people there. So people have asked me over the years, do we create misfits or do we welcome misfits? And the answer is yes.
Hmm. Interesting. If you're just joining us, we're talking about mental health in the restaurant industry with Patrick Mulvaney, who is a Midtown Sacramento restaurateur. I'm sure you're familiar with the name. And Nikki Thomas, whose experience with depression led her to get involved in the project Patrick started called I Got Your Back. We'd also like to welcome John Boyd into the conversation. He's the CEO for Mental Health Services at Sutter Health. And then, John, before I get to you, I do want to disclose that Sutter Health is one of Cap Radio's financial sponsors. So Sutter Health is one of several partners, including Kaiser Permanente, UC Davis, and Dignity Health in the I Got Your Back program. What is Sutter's specific role?
Sutter Health's specific role in the area of mental health is to be a thought leader and a policy informer, and meeting the community where the need is in their support of delivering effective mental health services. What happens in the workplace is an important, essential part of psychological safety within all of our communities. And the workplace is the natural place where social connections can happen, because so many of us spend so much time there. And that is especially true of the restaurant industry. So if we can build psychologically safe workplaces, do the incredible work that my colleagues here at the table have suggested, which is to raise awareness, eliminate social prejudice and stigma around having conversations about our own mental health. If we can do that in the workplace, we can move our communities forward.
And how are services provided? Because we know that healthcare is expensive. We talked about it in our very first segment today as we were speaking with Ben at the Capitol. Mental health is part of that. Working in the service industry, you don't have a lot of disposable income often to access these services.
So one of the incredible things about what this effort is achieving is bringing those services and awareness to the workplace. We as employers, leaders, managers have a responsibility to support open conversations and psychologically safe work practices. And so the incredible thing about this innovation that we're really talking about here is to move mental health forward into the workplace where employees work through social connection, awareness, and promoting psychologically safe practices.
Nikki, did you want to follow up on that? Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I saw you raise your hand out of the corner of my
In
eye.
In support, I was loving what he was saying.
Oh, you were doing the fist. Yes. Okay, good.
It's probably also important to note, as a commissioner on California's Mental Health Service Oversight and Accountability Commission, California passed SB 1113.
Right.
And that gave the commission I serve on the green light to develop voluntary workplace mental health standards. And as chair of the subcommittee on workplace mental health, we are looking for individuals and leaders to be involved on that subcommittee to ensure that California becomes the first state in the country to actually adopt well thought out, psychologically safety, voluntary standards for California. And Patrick's been a community light leader such as him is going to be a strong component of moving the work forward in California.
And Patrick, before we wrap up, how many restaurants in the Sacramento area are currently part of this? I got your back.
So we have been, the pilot that we have been running in Mulvaney's building and loan, starting in 2 weeks, will be run in 15 to 20 restaurants in the Sacramento area for the next 6 weeks, and then bring all that information back in through good graces of John and others, be able to, like we say, you let the straight world put together a professional piece, and then we'll be able to spread it out through the California Restaurant Association. So by the end of the summer, every restaurant worker in the state of California will have access to our information and programs and be able to start spreading it out more widely.
Sacramento has an amazing restaurant scene to be proud of.
And the last thing is that while one of the things that people like John has said is while we want to help, I want to help hospitality people by us talking about it, everyone from the garbage man to the governor comes to the restaurant and it lowers the stigma because they see us talking about it. And then it says to them, it's okay for me to talk about it too. And it will get better.
That's Patrick Mulvaney. He has the Midtown Sacramento restaurant Mulvaney's B&L, and who started I Got Your Back to help restaurant employees with mental health issues. Thank you so much, Patrick, for coming in today. Also, Nikki Thomas, whose experience with depression led her to get involved with the project. Thanks again for being here, Nikki.
Thank you.
And John Boyd, the CEO for Mental Health Services at Sutter Health. Thank you for being on Insight. All of you. We'll be back on Monday with another live show.